A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know that feeling when you walk into a place and something's just off? Not dangerous, exactly. Just wrong in a way you can't immediately name. Like a restaurant with no smell of cooking. Or a shop where the owner looks annoyed that you walked in, like you've interrupted something that definitely wasn't waiting for customers.
The lizard brain alarm. You can't articulate it yet, but your pattern matching system is already screaming.
That's the experience Daniel wrote in about. He was visiting a small town with a friend who grew up there, and they spotted a new business. The name suggested it was a supply chain company, but it turned out to be an electronics repair shop. Already strange. A name doing a different job than the business. They went in, started chatting with the guy working there. Daniel spotted a 3D printer and asked if they offered 3D printing services. Instead of a simple no, the guy launched into an unprompted diatribe about why 3D printing is terrible. The answer was no, but the answer came wrapped in a speech nobody asked for.
Over-explaining. That's a tell.
It gets better. Daniel does electronics repair himself. He knows the trade. So he figured while he's there, maybe the only repair shop in town would sell him an anti-static mat. When he asked, the guy looked at him like he'd requested a dancing flamingo rental. He had never heard of an anti-static mat. And when Daniel explained what it was for, the response was, essentially, I've never used one and nothing's broken yet.
Oh, that's the detail.
Daniel left feeling unsettled. Both he and his friend felt the place was sketchy. His question to us, what's the read on this? Is it a front? And what are some of the sketchy stories that lurk behind businesses that make no economic sense? So let's start with what we actually know about Daniel's shop, and then zoom out to the broader pattern.
The central puzzle is that most businesses that make no economic sense don't survive past 6 months. Rent comes due, suppliers want paying, and gravity wins. So when a business persists for years while seeming to violate basic economics, the explanation is rarely just, they're bad at business. Bad businesses die. Something else is keeping this one breathing.
And that's the fork in the road. Either the visible business is the real business and there's something we're not seeing, an inheritance, a pension, a B2B contract that keeps the lights on, or the visible business isn't the point at all.
That's the distinction between a failing business and a front. A failing business is trying to sell something and not succeeding. A front has a completely different revenue model. The shop, the signage, the workbench, that's set dressing. The real income is coming from somewhere else. Money laundering, moving stolen goods, or something worse.
So for Daniel's shop, we've got three buckets. One, genuine incompetence. Someone who knows some electronics, but not the business of running a business, and who somehow hasn't gone under yet. Two, a front for something else. Three, something weirder. A hobbyist who owns the building, or a retiree tinkering, where profit was never the goal.
Let's work through the case study. The name mismatch first. A supply chain sounding name on a retail repair shop. Most small businesses choose names that tell you what they do. A name pointing in a completely different direction suggests either the business pivoted and never rebranded, or the name was chosen to sound like something it isn't.
Or it's a leftover from a previous entity and nobody bothered to change it. But that's the first flag. The second is the 3D printing diatribe. Daniel asked a simple yes or no question. The answer should have been no, sorry. Instead, he got a speech about why 3D printing is terrible. That's not customer service. That's defensiveness.
And defensiveness is a classic indicator of deception. Legitimate operators tend to give short, neutral answers. Do you do 3D printing? No, we don't. End of exchange. When someone launches into an unprompted justification, they're not answering your question. They're managing a perception. They're performing legitimacy.
It's the verbal equivalent of someone who wasn't accused of anything saying, I have an alibi.
But the anti-static mat, that's the one that really lands for me. This isn't obscure knowledge. An anti-static mat is Electronics 101. It's a grounded surface that dissipates static charge so you don't fry sensitive components. Every electronics hobbyist knows what one is, even if they've decided to roll the dice and work without one. A repair tech who has literally never heard of an anti-static mat is like a chef who's never heard of a knife. It doesn't just suggest incompetence. It suggests the person isn't actually doing the work they claim to be doing.
And his response, "I've never used one and nothing's broken yet." That's not a professional's answer. A professional might say, "I know I should use one, but I don't bother." He didn't even know it existed. You can't choose not to use a tool you've never heard of.
That detail alone pushes me hard toward the "this isn't a real repair business" column. But let me bring in a concrete comparison. There was a case in Campbell, California, iTech Mobile Repair. Small electronics repair, shop, storefront, signage, repair bench, the whole nine yards. CBS News, San Francisco reported on it. The shop was actually a front for receiving and reselling stolen electronics.
So the repair shop was real enough to pass a glance, but the actual business was fencing stolen phones and laptops.
And here's what's interesting about iTech as a comparison. A repair shop is a great front for moving stolen electronics because it gives you a legitimate reason to have electronics coming and going. If someone sees you receiving a shipment of phones, you're a repair shop. That's normal. The business model provides built-in, plausible deniability.
Which is exactly what makes Daniel's shop a worse front, but a more obvious red flag. iTech had someone who could at least fake the trade. Daniel's guy doesn't seem to know the trade at all. That's not a good front. A good front is supposed to deflect scrutiny, not invite it. But it's also why Daniel walked out feeling like something was wrong. A front that can't even perform its cover story competently is going to set off everyone's alarm bells.
iTech had the cover story down. They had a functioning repair operation. The stolen goods were happening alongside the appearance of legitimate work. That's the professional-grade front. Daniel's shop sounds like someone who heard that repair shops make good fronts and forgot to hire anyone who knows how to repair things.
Which brings us to the FedPol framework. Switzerland's federal police issued a warning. This was in the last year or so, specifically about small businesses with no customers as potential money laundering fronts. They laid out specific indicators. No visible customer traffic. No online presence. Odd hours, a business model that doesn't generate enough revenue to cover the rent.
And those indicators are designed to be used in combination. No single one is enough on its own. A business might have no online presence because the owner is 65 and hates computers. A business might have odd hours because the owner has another job. But when you start stacking them, no customers, plus no online presence, plus odd hours, plus a business model that doesn't pencil out, that's when the pattern triggers an investigation.
Let's run Daniel's shop through the FedPol checklist. No visible customers. Daniel and his friend were apparently the only people there, and the owner's hostility suggested he wasn't used to walk-ins. No online presence. A supply chain named repair shop in a small town. If they had a website, Daniel probably would have checked it before walking in. Odd hours. We don't know this one, but the vibe doesn't suggest regular 9-to-5 retail. Business model that doesn't cover rent. A repair shop with a tech who doesn't know what an anti-static mat is isn't generating repair revenue.
By FedPol's indicators, this shop would be flagged, multiple indicators clustering. But let me play the counterpoint, because I think it's important. Some businesses are just weird. The owner might be a retiree who inherited the space and runs it as a hobby. The absence of customers might mean they do B2B work. Maybe they have a repair contract with a single local school district and don't need walk-in traffic. The anti-static mat ignorance might be genuine. I've met old-school techs who never used them and got lucky for 30 years. It happens.
The question is how you distinguish between weird but legitimate and front. And the answer is pattern consistency. A single red flag is noise. A cluster of red flags is a signal. That's exactly what the FedPol framework is built on. Name mismatch plus hostility plus ignorance of basic tools plus no customers. That's not one weird thing. That's a constellation of weird things all pointing in the same direction.
Let me zoom out to the knock-on effect, because I think this is where it gets interesting. What happens to a town when a front operates openly? It distorts the local economy. It takes up commercial real estate. A storefront that could be a bakery or a bookshop or an actual repair business is instead occupied by something that doesn't contribute to the economic life of the street. It doesn't generate foot traffic that spills over to neighboring businesses. It doesn't hire locally in a meaningful way. And it doesn't contribute to the tax base in the way a legitimate business would, because the real revenue is off the books.
And it can crowd out legitimate businesses. If you're trying to run an actual electronics repair shop, and the rent on Main Street is being bid up by a front that doesn't need to turn a profit because it's washing money, you can't compete. The front doesn't care about margins, it just needs to exist.
There's a spectrum here. At the low stakes end, you've got hobbyist-run shops that are really just someone's tax write-off. They're not laundering money, they're laundering a passion project through a business license. At the mid-stakes level, you've got cash-heavy businesses being used for money laundering. Laundromats, nail salons, car washes, takeaway shops. The FedPol warning specifically targets this category. And at the high stakes end, you've got intelligence fronts, stolen goods operations, human trafficking covers.
Electronics repair sits in an interesting spot on that spectrum. It's cash heavy. It's hard for an outsider to judge whether work is actually being done. You drop off a laptop, they hand it back a week later. You have no idea if they did anything or just wiped it down. It involves valuable, portable goods. And it gives you a legitimate reason to have people coming and going at odd hours. I was working late on a rush job. iTech proves this model works in practice.
And the takeaway shop that never has customers? Same logic. Cash heavy, hard to audit, and the inventory is fungible in a way that makes it easy to fabricate purchases. You buy $1,000 of ingredients, you claim you sold $2,000 of fried rice, and who's going to prove otherwise? The health inspector isn't auditing your books.
The thing I keep thinking about with Daniel's story is the hostility. Not just the 3D printing diatribe, but the whole vibe. The guy seemed annoyed that customers walked in. A legitimate business owner, even a grumpy one, wants customers. That's the whole point. A front operator wants to look like a business without actually doing business, and every real customer is a liability. Someone who might ask questions, notice things, take up time that could be spent on the actual revenue-generating activity.
Every real customer is a risk of exposure. You have to perform the role, and performing is work. If you're not actually in the repair business, every person who walks through the door is a test you didn't study for.
And that's what Daniel walked into. A test the guy hadn't studied for. The 3D printer question. He couldn't just say no. He had to perform an opinion about why 3D printing is bad, because a real repair tech would have an opinion. He overperformed it. The anti-static mat question. He couldn't perform knowledge he didn't have, so he defaulted to dismissal. It's the defense of someone who doesn't know what he doesn't know.
There's another layer here worth pulling on. Daniel mentioned that he does electronics repair himself. This is a subject he knows. And that expertise is what let him see the cracks. Most people walking into that shop wouldn't know to ask about an anti-static mat. They wouldn't know that a repair tech who's never heard of one is a walking red flag. They'd just think the guy was a bit odd and move on.
Which is exactly how fronts survive. They rely on most people not knowing enough to spot the tells. The average customer doesn't know what an anti-static mat is. The average customer doesn't notice that a takeaway has no delivery drivers coming and going. The average customer doesn't clock that a nail salon has 10 employees and 2 customers. The front operator is counting on the fact that most people aren't paying attention. And even when they are, they don't have the domain knowledge to interpret what they're seeing.
Daniel had the domain knowledge. And he still walked out unsure. He's asking us, what the hell was that? Because even with expertise, the signals are ambiguous. That's the thing about fronts. They're designed to exist in the gray zone between obviously criminal and just a bit weird. If they were obvious, they'd be shut down.
So what's the actual prevalence here? Are we talking about a rare curiosity or something more common?
Law enforcement agencies worldwide treat this as a significant problem. The FedPol warning isn't an isolated thing. Financial intelligence units in most developed countries put out similar guidance. The UK's National Crime Agency has flagged cash-heavy businesses as the primary vehicle for money laundering. The US Treasury's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network regularly updates its guidance on trade-based money laundering. This isn't a movie trope. It's a persistent, documented pattern.
And the reason it persists is that the front business model is remarkably adaptable. You need a business that handles cash, has inventory that's hard to track, and provides a plausible explanation for money moving through it. That's a huge category. Laundromats were the classic example for decades. Coins are untraceable, and who knows how many loads you actually ran. But as payments go digital, the model evolves. Nail salons, vape shops, ghost kitchens.
The electronics repair shop of today might be the ghost kitchen of 2030. As commercial real estate gets more expensive and cash businesses face more scrutiny, fronts will evolve. The underlying logic doesn't change. You need a cover story for money that can't be explained by legitimate income, but the specific covers will shift with the economy.
Let me circle back to Daniel's specific case, because there's one more angle worth exploring. He was visiting with a friend who grew up in the area. They were checking out this new business, partly out of curiosity about what had replaced whatever was there before. That's a small town dynamic. In a city, a weird shop might go unnoticed. It's just one more storefront in a sea of them. In a small town, a new business is an event. People notice. People talk.
Which makes a small town a terrible place to run a front. You've got more eyes on you, more people who know the history of the building, more locals who'll notice that you never seem to have customers. If I'm setting up a money laundering operation, I'm doing it in a strip mall in a mid-sized city where nobody knows their neighbors and the turnover is high enough that nobody asks questions.
Unless the small town is exactly the point. If you're moving stolen goods, maybe you want to be somewhere quiet. If you're running an intelligence front, maybe the small town gives you access to something. A military base, a research facility, a border crossing. The location might be the tell, not the contradiction.
That's a fair point. But for Daniel's shop, I keep coming back to the incompetence. A front that can't perform its cover story isn't a sophisticated operation. It's either very low stakes, someone washing a small amount of money through a hobby shop, or it's something weirder entirely. Maybe the guy thinks he's running a repair business and just has no idea what he's doing.
The Dunning-Kruger Repair Shop. That's almost more unsettling than a front. At least a front has a logic to it. A guy who believes he's a repair tech but has never heard of an anti-static mat. That's a level of confidence I almost admire.
Almost. But Daniel's question was about the broader pattern, not just his one weird experience. And I think the broader answer is, these businesses are more common than most people realize, they exist on a spectrum from merely odd to actively criminal, and the tells are hiding in plain sight if you know what to look for. No customers. Defensiveness. Ignorance of basic trade knowledge. A name that doesn't match the business. Cash only. Odd hours. Any one of those is nothing. Three or four of them together is a pattern.
The weirdest thing about Daniel's story isn't the shop itself. It's that we've all had a version of this experience, and mostly just shrugged. The takeaway with no customers. The convenience store where nothing seems to be in stock, but it's been there for 10 years. The mattress store that's always empty. Who's buying mattresses at 11 in the morning on a Tuesday? We notice, we file it under, huh, and we move on.
The mattress store is the canonical example. There's a running joke about how mattress stores must be money laundering fronts because they're always empty and somehow they survive. The reality is usually more boring. Mattresses have enormous markups. You only need to sell a few a month to cover rent, and the overhead is minimal. But the fact that the joke exists tells you something. People are pattern matching. They're noticing that something doesn't add up, even if they don't have the framework to articulate what.
Daniel had the framework. He noticed the name mismatch, the hostility, the ignorance of basic tools. He didn't just feel something was off. He could point to specific things that were off. And he still walked out unsure. Which I think is the right response. You don't need to know exactly what's going on to trust your pattern recognition system. The feeling of what the hell was that is data.
It's data, and it's usually right. Not always. Sometimes a weird business is just weird. But the feeling of wrongness is your brain doing Bayesian inference faster than your conscious mind can keep up. It's weighing base rates. Most businesses want customers. Most repair techs know what an anti-static mat is, against what it's observing, and the math doesn't work. The output is a vague sense of unease. That's not paranoia. That's cognition.
I had one.
Go on.
Brighton. Late 90s. Computer repair shop on Trafalgar Street. I was between things, and the owner hired me to sit at the front desk. Paid cash every Friday. 30 quid a day.
What was the shop called?
Something generic. PC Solutions. Computer Care. One of those. The sign looked like it had come with the building. My job was to answer the phone and take in repairs. The phone never rang. In 3 months, I think 4 people walked in. One of them wanted data recovery from a hard drive that had been dropped. The owner came out of the back room, listened for about 10 seconds, and practically threw the guy out. I remember thinking, that's weird. Data recovery is half the business. That's the profitable work.
Like the 3D printing diatribe.
Exactly like that. He was angry. Not at the customer, at the question. Like the question itself was the problem. I didn't understand it at the time. But now I think he was angry because the question forced him to engage with the actual business instead of whatever he was doing in the back room.
What was he doing in the back room?
On the phone, mostly. I'd hear him talking, but never about computers. Always about shipments, quantities, dates. I assumed it was parts orders. I was 22, I wasn't asking questions. He paid me in cash every Friday, and the shop stayed open for another 3 years after I left. I looked it up recently. It's a vape shop now.
Did you ever figure out what the actual business was?
No, and I don't want to know, honestly. But I think about it every time I walk past a shop that makes no sense. The guy wasn't worried. That's the part that sticks with me. A real business owner who had 4 customers in 3 months would be panicking. He was completely calm. Whatever was paying the rent, it wasn't walk-in repairs.
The calm is the tell. A failing business owner radiates stress. A front operator radiates nothing. Because the business isn't failing. It's doing exactly what it was designed to do. Look occupied while the real work happens elsewhere.
I thought I was bad at the job. No customers. I figured I was scaring them off. But he never seemed bothered. Just told me to bring a book. I read a lot of paperbacks in that shop.
The thing that strikes me about your story, Hilbert, is that it's almost a perfect mirror of Daniel's. The hostility to a specific question. The sense that the visible business was an inconvenience to the person running it. The cash payments. The persistence. 3 more years after you left. That's not a failing business. That's a business that was never trying to succeed at what the sign said it did.
I still wonder about the data recovery guy. He came in with a real problem, ready to pay, and got thrown out. That's not how anyone runs a business, unless the business isn't the point.
The data recovery question and the 3D printing question are the same category of tell. They're both questions that force the person to demonstrate actual knowledge of the trade they're supposedly in. A real repair tech can talk about data recovery in their sleep. A real electronic shop can answer a question about 3D printing without launching into a defensive rant. When the response to a trade question is hostility, what you're seeing is someone who can't answer the question and is angry that you asked it.
The owner had a workbench in the back with some computers on it. I never saw him touch them. Looking back, I think they were props.
The workbench is set dressing. That's the whole shop, really. The sign, the bench, the guy at the front desk reading a paperback. It's all set dressing. The real business was whatever was happening on the phone in the back room.
I still have one of the paperbacks. Some thriller. I don't know why I kept it.
The question Daniel's story leaves me with is what you do with this feeling. You walk out of a shop unsettled. You can't prove anything. You don't even know what you'd be proving. But your pattern recognition system is telling you something was wrong. Do you report it? To who? Hello, police. I'd like to report a business that seemed weird.
And that's the bind. Most people do nothing. They shrug and move on. And the shop stays open for 3 more years. The system works because people don't trust their own instincts, or don't think it's their business, or don't know who to tell. The front operator is counting on exactly that.
The one thing I'll take from this is that the tells are knowable. You don't need to be an expert. You just need to pay attention to the gap between what a business claims to be and how it actually behaves. A repair shop where the tech has never heard of basic safety equipment. A takeaway with no delivery drivers. A shop where the owner seems annoyed that you walked in. Any one of those is a data point. A cluster of them is a signal.
And the signal doesn't have to mean criminal front. It might just mean something here doesn't add up. That's enough. You don't need a verdict to trust the feeling. Daniel walked out unsettled, and that's probably the right response. The feeling is the point. It's your brain telling you the math doesn't work, even if you can't do the arithmetic out loud.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, and for the Brighton story I'm going to be thinking about for the rest of the week.
This has been my weird prompts. If you've walked into a business that made no sense and lived to tell the tale, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.